Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, explaining and analyzing critical decisions made around the world. Join the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We're joined by an eminent civil servant, public servant, I guess I should say, a man who has
right the first time, actually.
Well, in both cases, a servant of the American people in myriad capacities, notably as a distinguished federal judge, and of course as the Attorney General of the United States. His name is Michael Mukasey. He's been our guest here at Secure Freedom Radio before. We're always delighted to have him back, and especially honored to have you with us for two segments, Mr. General. It's great to visit with you again, especially at a moment when there's much in the news about the Muslim Brotherhood. And I thought it would be useful to spend a little time with you, sort of addressing the threat that you believe, based on your own experience as the judge presiding over the trial of the first the perpetrators of the attack on the World Trade Center the first time around back in 1993. And then, of course, drawing on your experiences as the Attorney General of the United States, what should we be thinking about the Muslim Brotherhood and its affiliates in the United States as we assess the threat that they pose to us?
I think what we should be thinking about is an organization that was found. I mean, this is not a new organization. They were founded back in the 1920s. They matured in the 40s and 50s. And It is an organization with roots principally in Egypt, but that has branched out worldwide, that has as its goal the imposition of Sharia in the Muslim world to start with, and across the board to the extent that it can, that operates in a way that is hidden when necessary, that is deceptive when necessary. That's part of its rationale. And that has as whose slogan is that Allah is our goal, Muhammad is our model, the Quran is our constitution, jihad is our means, and martyrdom in the way of Allah is our highest aspiration. That's their slogan. Now, for the head of for the director of national intelligence to get up and say that they are a largely secular organization that has eschewed violence, I think was the word he used, strikes me as either comical or terrifying.
Yeah. And at the very least, completely uninformed. And based, again, on your experience as a federal judge, you saw the willingness to use violence where it was deemed practicable. It's not as though it's completely off the agenda. It's simply a question of using it in a selective fashion, and when you can't use it for whatever reason, I guess working the same agenda through other means. Has that been your experience?
Yes, they work their agenda by deception when necessary, by appearing to be part of the society in which they're functioning, and then when they get the upper hand, they act accordingly. That is in accordance with their basic beliefs.
Right. And we know a lot about their operations in the United States, Judge, on the basis of material that was introduced in another trial, the 2008 Holy Land Foundation trial, specifically an explanatory memorandum. And I just wondered what your take was on both the validity of that document as reflecting their strategic goals and plans, and the importance that we should attach to its identification of groups associated with the Brotherhood that are operating, you know, quite aggressively in the public space today in the United States.
It's an entirely valid and authentic document, and It's as authentic as the Manchester document that was seized in England, describing the way Al-Qaeda operatives are trained and so on. I mean, occasionally you run across things that documents that give the game away, and this was one of them.
Yeah, they didn't intend for us to see it, that's for sure. But it does sort of serve as a Rosetta Stone, it seems to me, this explanatory memorandum. And I ask in part, General McKenzie, because we're finding people who have reason to try to obscure their own associations with these organizations and agendas, sort of calling into question the authenticity of these documents and the inferences that we should draw from the fact that we have Muslim Brotherhood front groups that are, among other things, providing what this gentleman, General Clapper, as you mentioned a moment ago, has called advice, counsel, and wisdom to him and others in the government. You served at the highest ranks of the United States government. I know you've had occasion to interact with some of these folks yourself. Is it advisable for us to be taking advice, counsel, and wisdom from Muslim Brotherhood front groups as we try to counter their efforts to destroy us from within?
It is not, because giving us advice and counsel is part of their strategy. The notion that we should somehow, I mean, it is a double disservice. First of all, to accept advice and counsel essentially is to be trapped. And secondly, it is to empower people who should not be empowered. And finally, what it does is to keep at a distance people who should be empowered, people who are true moderates, who get the view that these other people have seized the mantle of authenticity, and therefore that they don't have an opportunity to speak. We need to be very careful about who we conduct outreach to and who we actually believe and talk to.
Yeah, that point is so well taken, General McKenzie, because I think we all are counting on help from the Muslim American community, and the extent to which we wind up not connecting with those who are actually likely to be helpful to us by interfacing with them exclusively through these Muslim Brotherhood fronts is very worrying indeed. And I guess just to put a very fine point on it, is there any doubt in your mind, sir, that the Muslim Brotherhood is, in fact, present in this country and working with and through a quite considerable infrastructure built up here, as described in this explanatory memorandum going back to the 1960s?
Oh, absolutely none.
Yeah.
Absolutely none.
Well, this is one of the reasons why we so wanted you to be on, because I think at a moment when we're hearing a lot, as you know, in connection with Egypt, and we'll talk about that in a bit more in a moment, but at a moment when we're being told, really, there are moderates in the Muslim Brotherhood, there are people that we can do business with, there are folks who have proven their commitment to democracy in Egypt, I'm quite sure that we're going to start hearing people say not to worry about it here.
Have they proven it?
Yeah.
They may have articulated it. They may have mouthed it. They may have said it a number of times. I'd be interested to hear how they've proved it.
Right. Well, proof is generally absent, it seems to me, from an awful lot of this until it's too bloody late, to be honest with you. And that's really one of the vexing things about this, is where we've seen these things play out, for example, in Hamas, as you know. The proof is unmistakable, but it is awfully late for the people of that particular community. Judge McKenzie, one final question before we take a break. When you were Attorney General of the United States, there was this trial of the Holy Land Foundation underway down in Dallas, Texas, the largest terrorism financing trial in U.S. history. In your estimation, was justice done in that trial, in the convictions that were achieved? And in particular, if you could, as a former judge yourself, was it appropriate to identify, not perhaps publicly, but nonetheless to identify as unindicted co-conspirators this large number of folks that had been brought to our attention by the Brotherhood's own memorandum?
Absolutely. I mean, that's not something that's done lightly. It is done for the purpose, usually, of receiving into evidence statements by those people in furtherance of of the conspiracy. And so when they name unindicted co-conspirators, it's not done in any sort of promiscuous way. It's done with a focus and with a purpose.
Oh. Well, my guess is the purpose was to bring a prosecution against them subsequently. That hasn't happened yet. Judge, we're going to have to... I have to ask you to bear with me 1 second, Judge, if you would. We're going to have to pause here just for a moment, and we'll pick up on the other side of a very short break with Judge Michael Mukasey, former Attorney General of the United States, and one of the most thoughtful men I know on this whole business of the war on terror and what we're going to have to do to win it. Judge Michael Mukasey with much, much more straight ahead.
First line of defense in the war of ideas. Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of 3 children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a 5th grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a 5-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Charles the Carpet King will carpet your entire house for only $39. That's right, your entire house for only $39. But don't expect Charles the Carpet King to do it himself, because Charles the Carpet King passed away last week at 47 from the same disease that got his father, so he won't be around for his family. And sadly, it could have been detected early with a simple test, but Charles didn't get it.
Have you gotten the medical test you need? For a list of tests every man should have, go to AHRQ.gov. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined once again by Judge Michael Mukasey, former U.S. Attorney General, and a man who has, as I said, distinguished himself in his public career. He is also a practicing attorney and an author now of numerous very important pieces, both of the periodical version and of a new book entitled How Obama Has Mishandled the War on Terror, and something I want to come to in just a moment. But, Judge, before we do that, finish the thought that I had to interrupt you on concerning the unindicted co-conspirators of the Holy Land Foundation trial.
Okay. When I said not necessarily, what I meant is that in all cases, when one draws up a list of unindicted co-conspirators, that's not necessarily a list of people you intend to indict at a later point. It's often done for the purpose of facilitating the presentation of evidence at the trial at hand. Of statements by those people, but it's certainly not inconsistent with wanting to indict them later on. And to hear that they wanted to indict unindicted co-conspirators in the Holy Land Foundation case and were stopped from doing it because those were people with whom the administration was conducting outreach is not an encouraging fact.
No, it's worrying indeed. General, let's talk a little bit about your new book at Encounter Books, How Obama Has Mishandled the War on Terror.
I think it's something. It's it's odd to call it a book. I mean, it's one of a series of long pamphlets. It's called a broadside.
Point taken.
And it's meant to be read in a single sitting. It's about 40 some odd pages.
Yeah, these are, by the way, if I may just say, a terrific contribution to the policy debate by Encounter Books. Our friend Roger Kimball has inspired a lot of folks like yourself to take up a pen and put something together that is so readable. And I commend both of you and him for doing it. But give us the essence of your criticism of how we've mishandled the war on terror to date.
I think that what we've done essentially is to go back to a September 10th mentality in which we approach this problem by using the conventional criminal law in part as kind of a feel-good exercise. That is, we're going to, as was said during the campaign, we take the moral high ground in some undefined way by exceeding the requirements of the law. And all we do is paint ourselves into a corner when we do that, and tie our own hands.
Yeah. In that regard, one of the things that has been striking to me is that we continue to hear people cavil, and frankly, some of them are not, aligned with the Obama administration more generally, but on the right, about the Patriot Act as something that is overbroad and is infringing upon our civil liberties. The House of Representatives recently reversed an earlier vote and approved extending three provisions. But I just would, welcome your take on that, because the Patriot Act, in some ways, as you know so well, General Mukasey, was, an effort to break with that September 10th mentality, wasn't it?
Well, the Patriot Act principally contains provisions that apply to terrorism cases, the same kinds of solutions and tools that we can use in other kinds of criminal cases. You couldn't use roving wiretaps in terrorism cases, because terrorism cases weren't on the list of cases in which that kind of device was permitted. We could use them, and did use them, in narcotics prosecutions. The same for what are called sneak and peek warrants, which have been used for years, where you simply enter, examine a premises upon a showing of probable cause, and then leave without seizing anything. That requires a warrant, but that's something that's facilitated under the Patriot Act. Again, this is nothing new. It takes a lot of devices that have been used in other kinds of investigations and applies them in terrorism cases, and there's no reason not to do it, not to extend it. And for people to run around with their hair on fire over it, these are by and large people who have not read the statute.
Yeah, I fear that's right. And to the extent, especially over time, additional protections have been put in place in some of these provisions to ensure that they're subject to,
I think one of the gripes I heard about the Patriot Act as well is used principally in other kinds of cases, other kinds of criminal cases, to which the answer is so what?
That's a good thing, as best I can tell. Judge, let me ask you in this connection another sort of facet of the seeming, inadequacies, shall we say, of the approach of the current administration to the war we're in is in seeming indifference to border security. And I know this was something that you had to wrestle with as Attorney General. Give us a grade on that front, if you would, in terms of the current administration's handling of the matter.
Well, I think, they've kind of talked a better game than they've acted. We've heard about resources being devoted to protecting the border, but they don't seem to have been forthcoming. And the fact is that our borders, both the northern and the southern, are porous, and we need to do a whole lot more than we're doing, and need to enforce the immigration laws. I mean, I think when the government goes after the state of Arizona for criminalizing a crime, that's a good indication of where their expectations and efforts really are.
Yeah, and obviously, with your distinguished background on the bench, you obviously have an appreciation for what the failure to enforce the law means for communities like those in Arizona. In a case like that, is there any question in your mind that the state legislature of Arizona was acting appropriately in trying to ensure that federal laws were enforced, if not by the federal government, by their own personnel?
It's less a question of seeing to it that federal laws are enforced. They weren't acting out of an abstract concern for federal law. They were acting out of concern for the safety of their citizens, which is the principal responsibility of a state government. If a government doesn't protect its citizens, then its whole rationale for existence is undermined. They were acting to protect their citizens, and one of the ways that they were going to protect their citizens was by assuring that illegal immigrants did not conduct the kind of crime wave that they've been conducting in Arizona, and that they were going to arrest people for the crime of being here illegally. And there's nothing wrong with doing that. It is, in point of fact, a crime for somebody to enter this country unlawfully. And the fact of being calling people undocumented and so on is a nice euphemism. But the fact is that if somebody is here illegally, then they have had to violate the law simply to be present in this country. And there's nothing wrong with enforcing that.
And if anything, Judge Mukasey, since you left office at the end of the Bush administration, I have to believe you would agree that the imperatives that those in Arizona feel about protecting their citizens are only increasing exponentially with the threat on the other side of the border, not just from increasingly well-armed and aggressive drug gangs and smuggling operations and the like, but also now we're told by Hezbollah and Iranian elements and others that clearly have terrorism in mind, also taking up positions on that side of the border and perhaps coming through our porous lines of defense.
Obviously, the drug wars on that side of the border have had a lot to do with what's going on in Arizona, and the efforts of the Mexican government essentially have resulted in pushing this scourge further and further north, and pushing the cartels into a smaller and smaller area. Time was when they fought with one another. They've now started fighting with the government and with law enforcement. And the result is enormously dangerous for us.
Yeah, and I guess in some instances, at least, they're actually coming across the border and fighting with us. So this is no longer a confined problem, and the effects of tearing up some of your legacy, your administration's legacy of both a physical and virtual fence, or at least suspending their expansion, has got to be very worrying as well. Judge Michael Mukasey, I cannot thank you enough for your both civil and public service in years past, and for the great work and contributions you're making through your writings now and through your contributions to us here at Secure Firm Radio. I hope you'll come back to us again soon.
Thanks very much for having me.
Next up, we'll be talking with Don Rumsfeld, former Secretary of Defense, and one great guy. All of that and more in this installment of Secure Freedom Radio.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hey parents, finding it hard to communicate with kids in today's world of ever-changing slang?
Hi son.
Excuse me?
Introducing the Communicizer. Just strap non-toxic Communicizer to your mouth and go from boring old man speak.
I'm here if you want to talk.
To 100% off the chain.
Text me whenever, yo.
It's that easy.
Thanks to Communicizer, I'm relevant to my kids again. I mean, a fly, boo.
And now when you buy Communicizer, you get the auto-tune attachment free. Sounds so hip-hop, your kids will want to talk to you for hours.
I used to have to walk 3 miles uphill to school every morning, shorty.
I love you, Dad.
I love you too, son.
Communicizer is not available in stores because it doesn't exist. But that's okay. You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Because kids in foster care don't need perfection. They need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUsKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
For decades, the Democratic Republic of Congo has endured economic collapse, poverty, and war. More than 3.5 million people have died in the conflict. Today, rebel forces continue to wreak havoc in the eastern Kivu provinces. The International Rescue Committee estimates that 30,000 children have been recruited as soldiers, and thousands more have lost their parents. Most of these children lack the most basic level of goods, security, and most especially, clean drinking water. Yet, there is a well of hope coming to eastern Congo in a village called Uvira. Washington, D.C.'s National Community Church is partnering with Global Outreach to bring a water pipeline to the Congo for Christ compound, an orphanage for children who have lost their parents to war and AIDS. Building a clean water source will sustain the school, provide for the children, and hundreds more in the village. Go to www.waterforcongo.com. Learn about the work of Global Outreach and give. You can be part of the community in Uvira, and like a well, you can be a source of hope in life. www.waterforcongo.com.
Hi, I'm Drew Brees, NFL quarterback for the New Orleans Saints, here with Bugs Bunny to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you fuel your body and your mind.
So what do you like to throw around the football like Drew?
Skateboard.
Play frisbee in the park.
Ride a bike.
Kick the soccer ball around.
Or dance in your room.
Just move it your way.
Because nothing makes you feel better than moving every day.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
So be a player.
You'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
Move it your way and be a player.
Get up and play an hour a day, Doc. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
That's right, at letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
I'll pick you up after school. Okay, I got it.
It's easy to take a day for granted. You and your family are connected by routine, and you stick to it. But what if a disaster strikes without warning? What if life as you know it has completely turned on its head? What if your day's routine is disrupted and you can't reach your family? Have you planned for that? Before a disaster turns your family's world upside down, it's up to you to be ready. Get a kit. Make a plan. Be informed. Today. Learn how at www.ready.gov. Ready.gov. This message brought to you by the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the Ad Council.
1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back and joined by the Honorable Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense, not once but twice, widely renowned for being both the youngest man to hold that job and the oldest man to have that job, a man that I have been privileged to consider a friend for some years now, and it is a great, great honor to have you with us here at Secure Freedom Radio. Mr. Secretary, thank you for joining us. Thank you for your new book, Known and Unknown, a memoir, which has just come out to mostly, it would seem, rave reviews, at least in all the right places, and congratulations on that.
Thank you so much, Frank. It's good to be with you. I've spent 4 years. That's a long gestation period, but I'm delighted it's out, and we're giving all the proceeds, my proceeds, to the troops and their families and the wounded and the children of the fallen. So it seems to me that Joyce and I are so fortunate to be able to do that, and we have such high regard for the volunteers who serve in our armed forces.
Well, it's a marvelous thing for you to do, and I know it's deeply appreciated by the troops you led in the past and of whom you were one once upon a time back in your naval aviator days. You have an incredible story to tell, and I guess what I'd like to do, if I might, is invite you to cover what you consider to be really the high points of Known and Unknown with our audience at Secure Freedom Radio, Mr. Secretary, specifically with a view to looking at the points that you feel have not been given the attention that they deserve in the kind of reporting or reviewing or criticism of the book today.
Well, Frank, I debated, first of all, whether I should write a book, and I decided that I was been so fortunate and served in so many different positions over what now amounts to one-third of the history of the United States of America at 78
years. Hokey smokes!
That says what a young country we have, or else how old I am.
Well, a little bit of both, but that's an extraordinary statistic.
And then I thought about doing a short book, take a year and do it from memory, and I rejected the idea because I have such a rich archive. I have my letters, parents' letters back and forth to each other in World War II, and I dictated a note after all my votes in Congress and kept notes to action items that President Ford wanted me to do when I was chief of staff of the White House for the only president who was never elected, either president or vice president. And I don't know, something like 20,000 memos I dictated in the last 6 years I was at the Pentagon.
The famous snowflakes.
Yes, indeed. So I had this archive, and I decided to digitize it, and I've put literally hundreds of memos and thousands of pages on a website, Rumsfeld.com, where when there's a paragraph in the book that quotes a memo, you can go to the end note, and then you can go and actually pull up the entire memo off my website. The point being that we've tried to root this book into primary sources that people can then go and review themselves and make their own judgments.
Yeah.
My hope is people will read the book, and people who are interested in history and feel they were on the inside when decisions were being made, feel they have a sense of the complexity of the issues that senior people in government face, and come away with a better understanding of our government and hopefully recognize all of our responsibilities to help guide and direct our country.
Yeah, it's a real public service, both the book itself and this incredible archive, second only to WikiLeaks, I guess, in terms of the incredible opportunity that it affords historians and the rest of us, for that matter, to get that kind of perspective on events of the very recent past.
Big difference, Frank. All of my documents are unclassified.
Yeah, and approved for release where they were formally classified, right?
Yes.
The other book that comes to mind as I think about this was a man who's a friend of both of ours, who served you with distinction as your undersecretary for policy, Doug Feith, who I think had done a similar kind of conscientious effort to really root his material, his memoirs, if you will, his report on the facts and allow people to equip themselves with those facts and arrive at their own judgment. And I guess one of the things that's interesting is a criticism, though I don't think it's been a very frequent criticism, I must say, of your take on all of this, is that it's revisionist. There was a piece in the Washington Post yesterday, I guess now, to that effect. And I just wonder, to those who are coming down on a slightly different line on some of these facts and some of the conclusions that you draw from them, what would you say?
Well, needless to say, there's a narrative that evolved over the years through leaks and written essentially by people who weren't involved. Mm-hmm. And over time, people understood that narrative. And I had a policy in the Pentagon that we did not leak things to the press, and we preserved the president's options and supported government policy while we were in the government, and some others didn't. So there is the narrative out there, and what I've tried to do is to, by releasing so many documents to support the book that I've written, the memoir, I think that people will have a chance to see what actually took place at the time and have a better understanding of all of that.
Yeah. Let me ask you about a particular moment that I happen to think was really epical in the Iraq war context, and specifically after the liberation of Iraq was accomplished, and a lot of people who had supported you and the troops and the president in taking that step began caviling that there was actually there were no weapons of mass destruction found, and that this whole thing had been trumped up. And I was struck by one of the individuals who, in the aftermath of much of that, I gather, helped discourage the administration from challenging the narrative that Bush lied, people died, that, as you know, became such a meme to your critics, namely Karl Rove, who last year wrote in the Wall Street Journal that it was his biggest mistake, he thought, in his time in office, that he hadn't encouraged and facilitated a challenge to that narrative. And I just wonder with, again, your perspective on this, whether you'd agree that that was a terrible mistake and what should have been done at the time to you know, tamp down that ugly and, I believe, very disingenuous narrative.
Well, in my book, I discuss that, and I quite agree with you. I think Karl Rove is accurate in characterizing that as a serious mistake in the Bush administration. You know, Colin Powell is the one who made the presentation at the United Nations,
right,
laying out the intelligence that we had. It's intelligence that he, as a very senior government official, and probably had dealt with intelligence products as much as anyone in the government, even more than George Tenet, probably. He spent a great many days working on it and understanding it. He worked with Condi Rice on it and George Tenet. And he said at the United Nations what the intelligence community believed and what he believed. And what the president believed and what the vice president believed and what I believe, and I should add what the members of the United States Senate believed, John Kerry, Hillary Clinton, Al Gore, all of these people had seen the intelligence and had the same view. So did the intelligence agencies in the United Kingdom and in Germany and in France. They did not lie. They were telling exactly what they believed. And the idea that someone was misleading anybody about this, I think, is disgraceful. Colin Powell's an honorable man, and he spent a great deal of time, and he went to the United Nations, and he told the world what he honestly believed. And I quite agree with you that it was a mistake not to energetically defend that position.
Yeah. I really feel that so much of what flowed from that failure is still afflicting us today, afflicting, for that matter, the people of Iraq as we disengage perhaps precipitously and I fear maybe jeopardize all that has been bought at such enormous expense in terms of lives and national treasure, in the sense that we need to somehow compensate for this this false narrative. Don Rumsfeld is our guest. We are going to be speaking with him next, right after this short message, about the way ahead, his perspective from a very rich life recorded in Known and Unknown. Stay tuned.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I went from a size 18 down to a size 5, and I was able to keep it off.
Angie had some serious challenges.
I had gone through a divorce and put on quite a bit of weight. There was an accident where I was put on a lot of medications, and I put on over 60 pounds. I tried every kind of diet, but diets just did not work.
Diets don't work is something they hear a lot over at the MetaSystem from Judy Singer.
I heard about Judy Singer's MetaSystem, and I thought, well, you know, couldn't hurt to call, and I called them up, and they told me all about the product, and I thought, well, I'll give it a try. From the first week that I was on it, I wasn't hungry a lot, and it was just amazing. Jumping about 3 months ahead, I dropped 63 pounds.
If you're ready for a natural product that cleanses your system and helps you lose fat, talk to a Judy Singer counselor about the MetaSystem. Call 1-800-711-JUDY. 1-800-711-JUDY. The MetaSystem from Judy Singer. Powerful, all-natural weight loss. 1-800-711-JUDY.
Hi. This is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Hey parents, introducing the Communicizer. Go from boring old man speak.
Oh, you know, I'm here if you want to talk.
To 100% off the chain.
Text me whenever, yo.
I love you, Dad.
Communicizer is not available in stores because it doesn't exist. But that's okay. You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Because kids in foster care don't need perfection. They need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUsKids.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone.
At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home,
or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff,
like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really?
What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq-Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back with the former Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, the 13th and 21st Secretary of Defense, to be exact, a man who distinguished himself in public service in numerous capacities, including as a naval aviator in the United States military, as the representative from Illinois in the House of Representatives at the tender age of 30 years old, as a member of President Nixon's cabinet, ultimately the White House chief of staff to his successor, Gerald Ford, and then, of course, Secretary of Defense, not once but twice. Mr. Secretary, thank you again for joining us and for staying with us to talk a little bit about sort of a forward-looking assessment at the moment. I'm very keen to hear your thoughts about the advisability in the kind of world in which we find ourselves now of cutting military spending, particularly the investment in the modernization of our forces. Is this advisable? And if not, how dangerous do you think it might be?
Well, Frank, it's a mistake we've made in this country repeatedly over my lifetime. We did so during the 1930s. We did it again in the late 1940s. At the end of the Cold War, once again, there was a big drawdown. And every single time we've done it, we've been sorry we've done it. And we've had to play catch-up. We're living in a world today where the lethality of these weapons is vastly greater than it was before. And I should add, in a world of the potential for cyber warfare, our vulnerability is considerably greater because we are so technologically advanced, we're so dependent on digits, and we've thrown away the shoeboxes with the 3x5 card.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I would add is we can see what the People's Republic of China is doing. They're investing steadily. Their economy's growing, and they clearly have an intention to develop a world-class military.
Yeah.
All of those things, it seems to me, suggest that we need to look at the budget and face the facts. The problem with the budget is that there is an explosion in entitlements, and that is where the overwhelming portion of the budget is and the problem is.
Right.
Sure, there is discretionary spending, non-defense as well as defense, and there are always things that can be saved there. But the country really does need to face up to the fact that we live in a dangerous world. It's a world where, regrettably, it's going to continue to be very difficult for us to have the kind of intelligence that will enable us to anticipate and not be surprised. And the problem is, in the 21st century, in the information age, if you're surprised, it can be a surprise of enormous lethality.
Yeah. In fact, you, I think, coined the immortal phrase that weakness is provocative to get across this historical experience that it's not just that you can get surprised or blindsided, it's that you can actually be inciting, in a way, enemies to act in an aggressive fashion against you in the expectation that your weakness will reward them for their aggressiveness. Is this a problem that demands, in your judgment, a more distributed investment strategy than one that is focused principally on the kinds of counterinsurgency operations we're engaged in at the moment? You mentioned China as an example. Is it vital, in your estimation, Donald Rumsfeld, that we be preparing for wars that may be vastly more intense and sophisticated in their threat than the ones that we're engaged in at the moment?
Of course, the goal is to not be in a war. The goal is to be sufficiently capable that when people look at you, they see it's not in their interest to attack the United States or to put the United States in danger, which is exactly what you said, that the truth is that a weakness can provoke someone into doing something they wouldn't even think of doing right, if that weakness were not there. And so if one wants to avoid war, which has to be the goal, then what one wants to do is to be sufficiently capable that when people look at our country, they're dissuaded, they're yep. deterred. They realize it would be a terrible mistake to engage the United States, whether it's land or air or sea or cyber warfare or terrorism.
Right. Or space. And I want to come back to that in a moment. But before we do that, I want to just touch on something else that you spoke to, I thought, very importantly and eloquently at this Conservative Political Action Conference over the weekend. And that was the importance of sovereignty and the extent to which particularly our allies, but I would suggest even the United States itself, is engaging in a sort of subordination of national sovereignties to sort of transnational agendas and regimes. Give us a sense quickly, if you would, Mr. Secretary, about why that is, in fact, ill-advised.
Well, in my book, I've spent a good deal of time discussing this because it is something that worries me a great deal. I'll give you an example. I was at a NATO meeting, and while I was there in Belgium, in Brussels, where I used to live when I was U.S. ambassador to NATO back in the 1970s.
I left that out. Forgive me.
A lawsuit was filed against General Franks, Tommy Franks, our CENTCOM commander, for theoretical violations of international law under a statute in the Belgian parliament. I had a meeting with the defense minister of Belgium and pointed out to him that Americans are subject to the legal jurisdiction in the United States, and they're not subject to jurisdiction in Belgium or other countries, and that we are a sovereign country, and we respect our sovereignty, and to the extent Belgium insisted in keeping that law and having rogue prosecutors harass U.S. military personnel, it was clear to me we wouldn't be able to have NATO in Belgium. And the idea that we were going to modernize the NATO building there, which he was looking forward to, was a dream, because we simply weren't, unless they changed their law. Well, they changed their law. Right. But there are a great many countries, as you point out, that are engaging in what's called lawfare, where a rogue prosecutor will file a lawsuit. Even Henry Kissinger still has lawsuits against him in foreign countries for actions he took during the Nixon and Ford years. Yeah. And that is a trend, I think, that is terribly dangerous for the world. I say that because I think what our wonderful United States military did with the earthquakes in Pakistan and the tsunami in Indonesia, if we see lawfare expand and this thing called universal jurisdiction and a negation of our sovereignty, the American people are not going to want American forces to help out in Indonesia in a tsunami.
Yeah.
Or to help out in Pakistan. Why should we put our military forces at risk to harassing lawsuits in these countries, because those countries aren't wise enough to understand the importance of sovereignty?
Yeah, a terrific point. And I look forward to delving into this more with you in the near future. Mr. Secretary, could I just ask in the remaining minute or so we have with you very quickly, if you would touch on two issues that I know you've spent a lot of time on and very constructively. One is the importance of space to American security and I think the dangers of arms control regimes that constrict our ability to use and operate in space. And secondly, missile defense, where we are today and where we need to be going in that area.
Well, we made good progress in missile defense, thanks to President Bush and his decision to withdraw from the treaty with the anti-ballistic missile treaty with Russia. And we've put in place an early system that has interceptors and has been tested. And we've done several important things. First of all, we stopped calling it national missile defense, and we call it missile defense. And the reason we do that is because we do not want to leave the impression that we're only interested in protecting our country, because we've got friends and allies and interests around the world.
Right.
So we just call it missile defense. Second, it's not a perfect shield. It's in its early stages, but we now have the ability, thanks to the fact that the treaty's gone, to put in place interceptors and test them and experiment with them and improve them over time, so that gradually our capability to defend against rogue missile states like Iran or possibly North Korea will be there in place and protecting our country.
Unless the Russians object, and that's a subject for another day. As is space, Mr. Secretary, we look forward to visiting with you. We're just out of time. Thank you so much for joining us. Come again soon.
Next up, we've got Claudia Rosette on the nefarious UN. What it's up to, and what it'll mean for you. Straight ahead.
Miss a show? Find podcasts of Frank and the world's leading national security experts and policymakers at securefreedomradio.org.